Hello, and welcome to episode 99 of Our Current Predicament. It's the penultimate episode, and I thought I'd bring you guys something a bit different this time around. Over the course of the podcast, we've had many guests on, including many of the Bournebrook staff, Peter Hitchens, Collingwood, Bob Lollard. For the second from last episode, we'll have someone new, and that's my mum. Mum, hello.
Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm doing really well.
Yeah. Apologies if you can hear some interruptions. We are sitting in the garden, where there's wind and chimes everywhere, and it's interesting. So we recorded it in the house that I grew up in, and the garden's changed somewhat, isn't it? You finally sort of done something with it. Before me and my sister moved out, it was kind of like climbing frames and tree houses and paddling pools, and now it's kind of yours again.
It's mine again. It's getting even better. Butterfly flowers, that's the key.
Well, during the lockdowns, you kind of like made it your project a little bit, and you just like growing patches out here and.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I'm even growing vegetables, which has never happened before. That is quite an achievement. We have spinach.
And add to that your sort of collection of non-perishables in one of the rooms. You're preparing for some sort of food crisis.
Well, you know, I just felt like it was a good idea just to have a little bit of store. You know, so don't know in these days what's going to be happening, so it felt like a good idea at the time.
It's a good idea. I mean, if you walk into any supermarket these days, there's not a lot there.
And it's preparing without going into fear. That's my big thing. So, and if you've got some things in a cupboard somewhere that just makes you feel a little bit more relaxed, then you don't go into fear, and that's the biggest thing that we need to stay away from is fear.
Yeah, because we talk about this a lot, and your whole thing is sort of a mentality approach. Because how I would describe our different views in the world is that we end up in the same place, but we just go there via different roads. Myself from a more sort of traditionalist background, and you from a how would you describe it? Esoteric.
It's a really difficult one because there doesn't seem to be a word that hasn't been hijacked
and
given like unusual meaning, or not unusual, but different meanings to it. So you use the word spiritual, and then people start imagining, you know, something that's not true for you. I suppose it's about ultimately becoming more authentically who you are, about coming outside of the programming and having critical thought. It's about raising consciousness. It's about being in a space of love for self, for planet, and for everyone on it, and coming out of fear, because fear is the biggest virus of all.
You think? Yeah, no. I mean, obviously, you think you and I very early didn't buy into the COVID narrative, and so we sort of sat back and watched people lose their minds en masse. You know, I mean, you still see it in kind of scattered cases today where people are just so completely neurotic because they've been drip fed this terrifying narrative for.
What you have to bear in mind, as we've talked about before, is that these when you go into fear and you go into the fight and flight reflex, which is what fear is, flight is fear, and fight is the anger. So when people get angry, when they get fearful, when they shout at you for not wearing a mask or any of the things that they're fearful of, that takes you out of critical thought. You're in total survival mode, and when you're in survival mode, you don't have critical thought. It's not it, you know.
You're an animal backed in a corner. You know, a tiger in a corner isn't thinking of why it's
completely
swatting you. It's just getting out of that situation.
Completely. And that's where I've been able to find a deep sense of compassion, is realising that, you know, people have been, like you said, drip-fed fear. And by that, it's made their nervous system go into this extreme fight and flight, which we're meant to be in for, like, one tiger attack.
And then
our nervous system calms back down into a place of rest and digest, or into a place of peace. And that nervous system's being held in that fight and flight for nearly 3 years now, two and a half years.
Mm.
I mean, the impact is just unbelievable.
It kind of makes sense then why, if you're in that mind state and someone in a white lab coat gives you a needle, you put your arm out, right? Because, you know, you're told that that's going to alleviate that fear for you, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of people, my big thing, as you know, is self-responsibility. And a lot of people, again, we've been drip-fed over years and years not to be allowed to take self-responsibility anymore.
Mm.
You know, we have to hand responsibility to the government. They know best. And they can even tell us if the day's too hot, and they can, you know, we hand it over to the medical profession, and we hand it over to the school system, and we're not allowed as parents to challenge anything, and.
Yeah.
And so we've taken all our self-responsibility away, and then the one time when we really need to be standing in our sovereignty and being in our self-responsibility, we don't have those skills anymore.
Mm. Well, that's been happening for much longer than 3 years though, right?
Oh, well, complete. That's what I'm saying. It's, yeah. You know, it goes even down as far as, you know, to me, the speed limits on some of the roads. I mean, there's some speed limits you get, and there's other speed limits, and you kind of think, why am I going 40 miles an hour along this dual carriageway, you know?
Yeah, it's just arbitrary.
Exactly. So for my way of thinking, it's all about control and not about allowing people to be self-responsible.
I think another tactic that's used is sort of like a convincing the public to engage in like a sort of self-humiliation. Like there was this poster kind of went a bit viral the other day about in the speech in Australia, they were making people wear bike helmets if they were going for a run, right? Because, you know, there were loose rocks all around, you know. I mean, like, again, in a different, more serious time, people would have gone, oh, there's a rock there, I'll run around that. You know, people had the wherewithal to sort of look at what was potentially in the way. But with this, I mean, I think it's just a method of sort of humiliation as a means of control, because if they can get you to self-humiliate with no discernible purpose, then, you know, that's kind of a good sign for them. You know, it's sort of, you know, it's a litmus test of compliance among people, you know, because, you know, people do it. And like, Australia's been kind of the petri dish for all this stuff. You know, you have a population that is predominantly urban, who 20, 30 years ago handed over all their weapons to the state, and are sort of almost powerless now. And you see these videos of these sort of very aggressive Australian coppers just sort of taking the piss, really. And you saw that yourself, because you, I mean, I don't know if you want to go into this, but I can cut this out if you want, but I mean, you went to a lot of the protests in London.
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, first of all, let me just do that first point about the self-humiliation. Yeah, I agree with that completely. Possibly wouldn't use that word, but yeah, I do definitely agree. And what worries me, or what concerns me, is the children, that they start believing that that's normal, and that they start believing that you know, everything is dangerous and everything is frightening and everything is you need to be careful of. And risk taking is part of how you grow and how you develop. And yeah, I mean, I think the biggest piece for me personally is not seeing death as the end takes away the fear of death. And I think that's what's a lot of people, they're so frightened of dying that they don't want to live, which is just ironic and bizarre.
In a way, it's a consequence of sort of a post-spiritual age where the default setting is to be an atheist. You know, not someone who just isn't a Christian, but someone who believes in nothing. Believes that, you know, once you die, you're worm food. Or, you know, scattered ashes on a beach. And yeah, that has a very perverse effect, because not only do you live your entire life fearing its end, because to you it is the end, but you also, you don't live your life in a way that serves a higher purpose. You sort of, you live for yourself almost, you know. Like, as you know, one thing that's very important for me in a society is the aesthetic nature. So it's the art, the architecture. And the difference between a theistic and atheistic world that kind of transitioned in the last century was that those buildings and paintings no longer serve the higher purpose, they just serve the artists. So now you have all these grotesque high-rises in urban areas that are simply there because the architect wanted their moment in the spotlight, rather than, you know, if you look at any old church, you know, they're built as places of worship, they're built, you know, with a certain higher goal in mind.
Absolutely, and I mean, to me as well, beauty is part of that creation, and then creation is part of that belief that and that faith. And so you start taking that away, and you're dismantling that whole experience, if that's the right word. No, absolutely. And I just find it, I mean, I do feel that a lot of people that are, I mean, I find all these different words really difficult, like waking up. We are waking up from a sleep, from being hypnotized into becoming robots. But so people that are waking up are actually asking questions and looking outside and wanting more. And I have such huge, as you know, I have such huge faith in the human spirit, and I have such huge faith in that spark of God that we all have inside of us, that I do truly believe that humanity will come through this, albeit with some casualties on the way.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, the reason we actually did this recording is because you and I had a very in-depth chat a few days ago about this sort of thing. I do agree. I just think the distance between sort of an awakening event and the actual change into something better is, you know, could potentially be centuries. Or it could be weeks. I mean, who's ready to say? So I mean, I was saying to you, which I think you may have taken some issue with, was that I am on some level prepared for a lifetime of dissidence, which, you know, could lead to some not very nice outcomes myself.
So the way I see it, and this is where we get into our little bit of debates. The way I see it is that the vision you have in your head and the belief you have in your heart for how your life is going to be is exactly how your life is going to be. And the more you see the beauty in life, and the more you see the joy, and the more you see the synchronicities, and the more you see the possibilities, and the more we start actually actualizing this new way of being, taking self-responsibility and being all that we are in all our magnificence, then we've already created it. There is no need to worry about the distance, and all that rubbish can go on the outside, because in my heart and in my life, I'm already living that life.
No, which is sort of how I've sort of managed to taper it off, is saying, you know, in my lifetime, the world may never be the way I want it to be, but I can still be happy.
Yeah, we can still create within that. You know, the space. It's almost like the Amish people. They've carried on exactly with their kind of life regardless, haven't they? And I mean, like, there's no reason why we can't do the same. It's just, you know, it's just finding, it's creating our own systems. We don't need to be in these broken systems anymore. My concern is if too many people start thinking, oh, it's just going to be awful and it's going to be terrible for years and all that, that we're almost feeding into that fear again. And that's what feeds the machine, for want of a better way. That's what feeds the matrix.
Although, you know, I think two things can be true at once, and, you know, because again, like, I almost can't help but believe that we are on the precipice of something really, really ugly, if we're not already there. But again, at the same time, it is true that in that world, regardless of it, there will still be, you know, serenity, and there'll be beautiful things, and there'll be, you know, wonderful people with whom I can make life worth living in. Yeah, those two things can be true at the same time.
But the other thing, so let's just kind of, you know, if you go back to 2020, I can remember waking up in the middle of the night in abject terror because they were bringing masks in. And then, you know, a few months later, being in abject terror because they were going to bring in mandatory vaccines. And those things, to me, felt like those boots marching, like you kind of said. But actually, I'm travelling, I'm doing my life normally, I don't wear a mask.
I mean, ironically, you're going to Australia.
I'm going to Australia, yeah, because they've opened up to unvaccinated. You know, someone I know came in to see me on Friday, Thursday, and she's been to America with false documents. So, I mean, you know, where there's a will, there's a way, and all that belief that it was going to be awful and horrendous, it just didn't happen. It hasn't happened, you know? And I think there's so many people now that kind of wish they'd waited and stood their ground.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, like, so one memory that I recall from that time was I was going to the shop to buy something for you because you were very unwell. And this would have been during the first lockdown, and it was like an apocalyptic scene. It was like there was no food in the shops. Everyone was wearing masks. I was walking down the street, and people would jump into oncoming traffic rather than walk past me on the street. You know, it was a really really horrible scene in the early days. And I think. In a way, because you were bedbound, you were kind of insulated from that in a way. Like, that first few weeks was really horrid to be outside.
Yeah, and there's a part of me now that's very grateful I was ill. And I did have COVID, and I wasn't well. I was ill.
Right at the start as well, yeah. Right at the start.
Went down with it on March the 13th or something, and we went into lockdown on the 23rd. And I was really, really, really unwell for a month. I'm not going to get into all my belief about what that was all about, but I truly felt that it was an outcome of the life I'd lived for two years before that, where I'd had huge amounts of stress. It was a challenging time going to the shops and seeing that, and I'm very relieved that I didn't see that, because I can imagine that image kind of gets stuck in your mind, and then you start believing that's going to come back. But for me, you know, in a way, let's flip that and say, rather than you believing it's going to come back, look where we are now. So it's like all these things are transient. They're not the way our life is going to be. Mm. You know.
I mean, so you mentioned, obviously, you know, again, we won't go into it, but that period right before 2020 was quite tough for the family. So you mentioned you were in a lot of stress and, you know, a lot of fear and uncertainty and trepidations. And, you know, do you think that made you more sort of vulnerable to what happened?
Completely. I mean, completely. To me, stress actually is the key factor in most illnesses, and how strong or how difficult those illnesses become for people. And let me explain that a bit more. When you're stressed, this is your fight and flight reflex. And if you can imagine, your fight and flight reflex is when your fear of being attacked, or fear that you're going to be in danger outside, so fear of danger of being injured, or being danger of being hit by a car, whatever it is, you know, attacked by a tiger, saber-toothed tiger or whatever. And that's your stress system. But actually, your stress system is still part of your immune system, because your immune system is keeping you safe inside. It's the one that fights the bacteria and the viruses and all the rest of it. Now, when your stress system is being triggered from externally, one of the things the body does is it's so busy dealing with that it switches off a lot of our natural systems. So it switches off our healing, and it switches off our immune system, or turns the dial down very low. It's probably a better way of putting it. It doesn't switch it off, but turns the dial down very, very low. And so straight away, because the idea is that you're going to run away from the tiger, or you're going to, you know, clear the stress, because we're only meant to be in that kind of level of fear or, you know, anger or whatever for a short period of time. Then we're meant to have got away. We're meant to have dealt with it. So the body switches it off to put all the resources to deal with that. And then once that episode has gone, then the body goes back into the healing and the immune system working and so on and so on. But you start giving stress for a long period of time, like I had before all of this, and like other people have, and then you bring in a virus or a illness, the body doesn't have the ability to do both. And that's when you're much more vulnerable.
I think the stress almost seems worse now, because, you know, because if you if you do so much as, you know, leave the house or open your phone or, you know, go onto any public forum, you see that, you know. I mean, you know, the you know, I mean, granted, I use Twitter for work, but I mean, it's still, you're still honest, and you still sort of get this snapshot into, you know, the less savoury parts of the world, and it does, you know, create stress. It's almost like, in the sense, you're bombarded with it, especially when you and I are so morally opposed to the ruling class. You see their little, like, pet projects everywhere you go. I mean, you know, like, it's funny because when I was a kid and we would go see my grandmother, your mum, she'd always mute the adverts, right? Because, you know, she said that they were just propaganda. And we always thought she was a bit wacky for that. And then now... now she's been vindicated.
Yeah, and
that.
Now we move the adverts.
Yeah, now we move the adverts.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, and say thanks, Nan, every time. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it depends where your belief pattern is about whether you think this is a huge, massive catastrophe by mistake or whether it's planned by a ruling elite or whatever. But it, in my opinion, is a massive, massive, massive psychological operation that's been going on.
No doubt.
And that is the whole point. That's what I'm saying. Fear is the virus, because the whole point is to lock people into fear. When you're in fear like that, you are much more controllable, and that is the key.
One comparison that I make to it is, imagine you're drowning in a body of water, then all of a sudden a hand comes through the surface and grabs your wrist. You're going to hold on to it because, you know, you're drowning, right? Or at least you think you're drowning. Perhaps you aren't, and, you know, and the hand is just dragging you into something, you know, more severe, you know, worse.
It's absolutely. It's been such an interesting time. I mean, I can honestly say that the last 2.5 years have been the best 2.5 years.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean,
I absolutely. I mean, I feel more alive now than I've ever felt. I feel more me than I've ever felt. I feel excited for the future, which is.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Yeah.
I've made the best connections. I've had the most interesting conversations and experiences over the last 2.5 years than I think I had the whole of my life before that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm the same. I mean, you kind of, I suppose you in a way you kind of witnessed it happen. But, like, you know, I think you were very worried about me before all this happened, right? And then now I'm sort of much more authentically me. You know, I was kind of in that post-university oblivion when it came around. You know, I'd finished university a year before, and I wasn't happy. But then now, you sort of see these new components become part of my life. Everything from, you know, starting with the podcasting and working with Bournebrook to the poetry and the novel, and, you know, you sort of witnessed it happen with me as well.
And it's been my biggest joy to watch that, to see that. It's been absolutely incredible. Sorry, slushy mum moment. Sorry about that, people. But it has. I mean, you know, it was like before you were lost, because that whole machine was all around us, but we didn't realise it was there. And we didn't even know we needed to find our tribe or our group of people. We didn't know we needed to find a way out, because we just assumed that was it. And although I knew that it was there, I suppose, and suddenly there's this opportunity to be with like-minded people and actually start creating something so different, like you have with all the things you're doing. It's just exciting, and like I say, seeing you blossom has been a joy.
I think the strange part, though, is that, like, I was always, you know, because we were talking the other day, and, you know, I was always someone who stood on their own feet, sort of always did their own thing, and yet I'd sort of in a way rejected that reality about myself, where, you know, prior to COVID, I thought that a 9-to-5 job would make me happy, and a career would make me happy. When now that I'm, you know, 3 years older, I see that was so wrong of me. And
but again, that's part of the programming, and also, you know, this is how you're meant to live your life. This is what you're meant to do, which is bonkers. And how that's another thing that I'm so, you know, COVID has given us such blessings. because again, well, it's given you that space to explore that without, you know, I wonder what would have happened and how well you'd have got to this point if COVID hadn't come along.
Well, I'd be doing what I was doing in 2019, which wasn't making me happy, you know. I was out the house at, you know, 6:45. I was back at 7 p.m. and I wasn't happy.
No, I know. And, you know, sort of knowing that side of you, knowing that you were always different, doesn't sound right.
No. I mean,
you didn't fit the mold, and that's what made your life difficult in a way, because you didn't fit the mold, and then people made you feel that you were wrong rather than the mold was wrong. And then you tried to fit the mold and that didn't work either. And like now finally the mold has got completely broken and you are just all of who you are, which is just incredible. So thank you, COVID.
Honestly, I can't put it words off in that, you know, it's actually been an incredibly, again, obviously, you know, I'll go back to the saying, you know, two things. There are two simultaneous realities, which is, you know, or three, I suppose, but two here are relevant, one being one's own life and the other one being the mass society, right? The third being, you know, the beyond, the part that, you know, our bodies aren't equipped to walk in yet, you know, which only comes with death. And yeah, while the latter, the mass society, has, you know, basically been given a microdose of cyanide in a way, or just, you know, it's been lobotomized, my own life has sort of, it's been a very strange blessing for me. You know, I just had the space and freedom to figure things out, you know. And yeah, you know, I'm almost 26 years old, but I mean, better late than never, right?
Yeah, but then again, that's part of the programming, is to believe that you're meant to have done it by 26. That's part of the, you know, you're meant to know what you're meant to, you want to do it at 16 or 15, you know, when you're meant to choose this and choose that and then go into this and, you know, into your mold, into your box. And then people just try and cram themselves in. And what they try and do is they fit themselves into the box rather than making a box to big enough to fit them, if that makes sense.
Not even big enough, just their shape, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But again, you know, it's do you remember Plop? Plop.
I do.
Do you remember just the name, right? Just Plop. Plop was a story that I wrote in year two. That it won an award, like a classroom, like a certificate. It was a short story that I wrote about a ghost who's afraid of the dark, and that was the first thing I ever wrote. And I suppose back then I still wanted to be a football player, and you had to sit me down and tell me that I wasn't gonna play football professionally. But then from that point onwards, I kind of just, at the back of my mind, I always wanted to be a writer, and I really wish I still had that story. I remember it, but I don't have it. Since then I've been sort of, I think my life since then has been a slow motion sort of epiphany that it isn't impossible. It's difficult. It takes a lot of work, you know, and this novel's sort of taking a lot of time and it's, you know, a lot of effort. But I mean, you know, at this point I can't think of anything else that I wish to do rather than, you know, but not even just write the novel, but also, like, just, you know, write and be free and, you know, not have to, you know, give a third of my life to a company who would replace me in a day if I died on the job.
And your poetry is just something else. It takes you to places that are just incredible. So what a gift you are bringing to the world. And I can't wait to read the novel, because that... You know, we talked before about each person has their own unique part in the tapestry of this life we're all creating, this new world that we're all creating, and every piece is unique and but totally relevant. And you know, one person's role might be just to be someone that smiles at people. Another person's role might be, you know, to be the one that goes and stands, you know, face to face with a policeman that's doing something, you know, unacceptable, or, you know, by you writing, who are you, what are you stimulating in people, what are you opening up in people? With, you know, with my work, with helping to heal and to help people to find their inner authentic self, which is just, you know, and every single one of them together is creating this tapestry that we're now building. And this idea you said about mainstream media and, you know, the mass society, that's the illusion we're being given. I think you'd be amazed. I think we would be amazed at how many people actually don't really feel comfortable, don't really want it, don't really buy into it, but don't know that there's a way out. And that's part of what we're doing. We are the way showers. We are the people showing people there's another way to do this.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what we're trying to do at Bournebrook is sort of saying, you know, it doesn't need to be this way. You know, there is another way of being. But going back onto the whole not fitting the mold thing, I mean, obviously I do think parents are very influential, which is why, as a side point, it's so concerning to see the sort of the regime apparatus kind of move towards kind of like taking parents out of the equation when it comes to their children, i.e. what they're learning in schools, or if, you know, Andrew wants to become Andrea, you know, at 5 years old, you know. But for me, it was such a big thing, and I'm only realizing this now in my 20s, the influence that you and Dad had, where you guys were always self-employed, you know. You had your healing practice and your clinic. My father's is a musician who owned a cafe for many years. So I never had parents who were gone before I woke up and back after I went to bed, which so many kids do, you know. And at the school that I went to, this is just contextual. It's not a boast, but me and my sister did go to a fee paying school. And at that school, essentially, we were the poor kids at that school, right? We were, and Dad would come get me in his beat-up little Renault car, and, you know, meanwhile, my friends were getting picked up in Land Rovers and Porsches, right? And that never bothered me, because deep down, I always knew that those kids, while they had everything they could ever ask for, materially, their dad was in London for 60 hours a week. More if you factor in the commute, and they never saw them, you know. I remember going to friends' houses in that school, and I'd only ever meet the mums, because the dads just were not there, you know.
No, I know, and your dad was around a lot.
Yeah, he was there. Yeah,
which is really good. I mean, we were able to follow our dreams and to do the work and the what we wanted to do. But what's really bizarre is it never occurred to me that we couldn't. It never came into my mind to be go and get a job. It was just never came into my head that's how maybe I could do that. It was always self-employed and self-responsibility, because it's not easy being self-employed. It's a lot of hard work, but it's different and very fulfilling.
I mean, you get paid in anything that's more important than money, right? Because, I mean, again, that's one thing you always taught me, was that money is not everything, you know. It is a sort of an ebbing and flowing thing, you know. It is always just, you know, like a nice little bonus every now and then, you know? Because obviously with you and Dad being self-employed, I mean, we had good years and bad years, right? You know, for every year that we went to California, we went camping in Yarmouth, you know, which I still look back on very fondly, regardless of what it was, because we were together, you know, and it wasn't like, you know, your dad were taking work calls and work emails the whole time, and, you know, I actually got to grow up with a mum and dad, you know.
Yeah, very much. I mean, when we weren't working, we were with you. That was it. There wasn't this the life that people have to live now. We were very, very lucky, and I count my blessings on that all the time. Very, very much so. But going back to what you said about money, I've changed quite dramatically how I look at it now. I just see it as energy, and it's just energy flow. And it's trusting that energy will flow, and trusting that there is enough for everybody. There's not this idea that there's only so much to go around, and if someone's got a big chunk of it then is not enough for somebody else. Is I just don't see it that way anymore, because energy is constant. So yeah, that's been an interesting change for me, particularly in the last 2-3 years again.
It's again, we're sort of walking circles here, but I mean it's it's endlessly fascinating how actually beneficial it has been. And this is not to excuse lockdowns. I think that they have in many ways caused an irreversible scar on society, especially among children, but people like us who just by some divine miracle are just immune to the programming. It's actually given us a chance to recalibrate and figure out a life for us that's sort of better for us, because again, you know, without COVID I would be in 9-to-5 oblivion. You know, and you'd be working yourself to death, you know.
I mean, you know, yes, I don't want to make light of people that are struggling and people that are having a really hard time and have found this last few years, you know, immensely difficult. And there's been times where, you know, I said before, I was so angry or so frightened by what I could see, and never by a virus, but what I could see coming down the line with this control and everything else, that it made me look inside and find my courage and my strength, which I'm so grateful for. But I'll come back to what I've said earlier. I really think that this is, we are the way showers. You know, this is that we don't have to follow that particular route. We can follow a new route, and everyone's route, it will be different. And we have to be in a space of non-judgment and compassion and allowing people to follow their journey and follow their path, which is all a bit cliche things to say. And sometimes you wish you didn't say it in those ways, because it's like, again, it's been overkilled sometimes, these languages, these words, but it is true. It really is true.
Yeah. Mum, I think we'll leave it there. I mean, it's a shorter one, but I mean, I just wanted to sort of sit down with you and just, because we have so many interesting conversations, particularly quite late at night, over the dinner table, and you know, given that the show's coming to an end, and you know, this show is where my new direction in life really began. It just made sense to me to have you on for one episode.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I mean, yeah, and I'm just excited to see where your life takes you now, where you go with all the amazing talent you have and with all the ability you have, and the fact that you're, you know, you kind of really know who you are at 26. Nearly 26. Don't make myself older than I am.
You were married to my dad when you were my age, so yeah, I still have some way to go on that front, but thanks mum, it's been a pleasure.
I've loved it, thank you.
All right, thank you for listening, and I'll see you again next week for the final time. Cheers.